Big transfer news today.
Who's moving?
Me. To the couch. With Domino's best deal ever since they just added stuffed crust.
Any pizza, any toppings, now with stuffed crust for $9.99.
It's a long-term contract with no release clause.
Only $9.99? Yeah, that sounds like the move. I'm heading straight to
Domino's.
Prices higher for some locations. Excludes XL and specialty pizzas. Select this offer from 6/15 through 7/26. Online only. Size availability varies by crust type. Max 7 toppings, 6 for pan and New York style crust. Minimum purchase required for delivery. Prices, participation, delivery area, and charges may vary.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
The world's biggest soccer tournament has arrived, and you can trade the entire tournament on Kalshi. Spain is currently trading at over 17% to win it all, meaning a $100 trade pays out over $530 if they win soccer's biggest prize. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code JUMP to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see Kalshi.com/regulatory.
This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Lots of people getting up in arms about this, so we're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about the reality of what could actually happen here in the Nick Reiner case. Nick Reiner just filed a 136-page petition demanding over $1.5 million from a trust his parents set up when he was a baby. As my doorbell rings. And here's the uncomfortable part. He might actually have an argument. The petition says the payouts were mandatory at 30 and 35 in terms of years. Bell, it's okay. We're good. Mandatory at 30 and 35. No strings, no discretion. Nick turned 30 more than 2 years before his parents were killed and reportedly never saw a dime of it. So that's the interesting part going into this. This payday would have been 2 years before the murders took place of what he was supposed to get mandatorily. This is the claim that the Nick camp is making. And he wants it. He wants to use it because he wants to hire Alan Jackson back as his representative. And the way it's sitting right now, they're saying, no, you're not getting the money. Eric, let's walk through this. I mean, what sort of grounds does he stand on to get his money?
Reasonably solid grounds, I think, Tony, with respect to the disbursement to which he was entitled at 30. With respect to the 35-year-old disbursement, that's a whole different story. But for the 30-year-old one, that was before any allegation that he had harmed his parents. It preceded that event in time. And so it sounds like he was legally entitled to those funds. For some reason, they were not paid. And it's appropriate to bring a legal action to try to enforce what a trust says and to get those funds.
Yeah, I'm curious, Eric, because I did a lot of research on this morning just because I'm trying to understand trust, why people have trust. Basically, it's for people with a lot of money want to protect their money is the bottom line of it. But I'm really curious because, yeah, they wrote it in. And once the family creates a trust and they created it when he was born, it's like removed from their control. It's tax sheltered. It's entitled to the kids, and they do it. And gradually, as they get older and hopefully more mature, they can use it more more responsibly. So, at what point then? How come the trustee of this and the new trustee came on board? I guess about a year ago from this. How does he even have control when it's actually written into the contract to begin with? So, how could he even withhold it a couple years ago, even though I know there was issues with his mental health and things like that, but how could he even held it back then?
It's not entirely clear to me what legal authority the trustee would have to withhold those funds. I mean, the trustee in this kind of an irrevocable mandatory trust scenario is really charged with effectuating the terms of that trust. So they sort of do the mechanics of it. They make sure people get paid. And I'm not aware of some legal authority this trustee would have to say, for whatever reason, I don't like this guy, or his mental health is concerning me, or whatever, or his substance use, what have you. I'm just not going to give him these funds. I'm not sure the trustee has that discretion.
Because that actually raised a question with me in the sense of, all right, so because like you said, the language in that trust, I've never seen this one, but doing the research on them in general, it's very solid, rock solid. It is what it is. Could he then become in legal jeopardy for it actually not executing it according to the timeline?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, it's sort of, it could be just a general negligence theory that, hey, you had a duty under this trust to disperse these funds, and you ought to have, and you didn't. And now this person is out all of this money, and perhaps Nick has suffered other claimed losses from the non-disbursement. And that trustee could be in a precarious situation.
And one more before I bounce back, Tony, so sorry. So, again, my conjecture hat is on. This is what happens when I'm away for a couple of days, right? So Alan Jackson said he's willing to be back on the case now that there's money back on the table. And he didn't say that first time, but we said it was probably because of money. So is there a possibility that Nick, now can he do this when he's, you know, being charged with this, could file a civil lawsuit against the trustee that Alan Jackson could then also do to get money from, like, both from the trust as well as a civil lawsuit from withholding?
Hard to say. Alan Jackson might have some kind of conflict because he is set to gain from the proceeds of such action,
right,
such that he couldn't be an objective legal counsel on it. So I'm not sure if he could do that, but I can see why he might want to.
Right. Are we staring at motive for murder here? The fact that he didn't get his money 2 years before he murdered them?
Oh, wow.
Look, wow. Yeah, that's that hadn't even occurred to me. You know, I don't know how much money is in controversy here, but we're talking about Rob Reiner, a famed
producer,
director, and actor for decades. I bet it's a lot of money. And if a person was out, you know, seven figures or more, they'd be pretty peeved. And that could compel them to take some action based on that feeling.
I'm wondering, because we've been sitting here going, why did he do this? Well, he's, you know, mentally ill. He's got this schizoaffective disorder. It's this, it's that. He probably didn't get his money, is what it seems to look like here. 2 years before, you're supposed to get your $1.5 million. It's a lot of drugs he can buy with that for a period of time. It seems like this may be making a lot of sense now when you kind of line it up with the broken brain, the thinking. I mean, him still living at home with his parents up until the end. I could see Nick thinking, I'm going to play the game. Eventually I'll get that. And I wonder how much of a carrot on a stick this money was that was being dangled up by mom and dad. You need to stay with us. You need to get clean. And then you'll get your money. You just need to do this. And then we'll trust you with it. I mean, this is all my conjecture, but I'm thinking this may lead to some very interesting roads to go down. And if it does go down that road, not that there's ever a justification for murder, but I am wondering if this is going to be, you know, brought up. It's not like, I don't know that they're going to be able to argue that Nick didn't do this. It's pretty clear he did. But what are the circumstances to which he did it under? Why did he do it? When, you don't have to prove motive, but if you're trying to sway a jury in one way or another, he's mentally ill, he needs help, and then his parents are withholding this money, and then he lashed out and killed them.
So it's interesting. So Eric, based on that, and that's a really interesting thing to bring up, Tony. So legally, because it looked like there was an argument inside the house, and that's what the conjecture is. Mm-hmm. There's a fight, an argument, but never really an understanding, because they're just claiming mental illness and all the garbage going on in his brain. And that's what Alan Jackson said he's going to do, is claim, you know, by means of insanity. But they're always looking for a triggering event. Could they use this then as a triggering event, as saying, hey, he didn't get this, and would that help or hinder defense or the prosecution?
Yeah, it doesn't matter, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, in thinking about it, it seems like it wouldn't help the defense in a not guilty by reason of insanity defense, because in that defense, you're arguing, hey, he didn't know right from wrong. You know, sometimes those folks are under delusions and hallucinations, and they don't know what they're doing. They can't control their faculties, things like that. But if you have a concerted plan, if you have a sequence of events, like this guy got pissed off because he was entitled to more than $1 million and realized his parents were withholding it wrongfully from him, and then he went after his parents because of that. That seems to suggest he does know right from wrong. He did know what he was doing. He did this on purpose, and it seems to undercut a potential not guilty by reason of insanity.
Yeah, this could be really good for prosecution. Yeah, I see someone put it in there. Yeah, $1,600 to $2,000 per hour. I saw that. And so Alan Jackson typically looks for $250,000 as a retainer fee. And so Nick Reiner is due $750,000 if he ruins the lawsuit for half the conservatorship that he should have gotten already. The rest of it, it's actually can be withheld, because you can't profit from the death of, in other words, if you are the cause of death of someone, you can't get their inheritance.
Yeah.
And so that's why the other half's being held up.
I mean, and we'll get to that in a moment
of what sort of
levers the family can pull here. But it does make you wonder a lot about what, you know, what are the motivating factors here? And is this something, I mean, is Nick Reiner a prime example of why maybe mom and dad or whoever has the money and has reproduced a spawn and thinks, you know what, I got some money, I'm going to start a trust right now, so when they're older, they can have it. There's a lot of assumption that goes on when you create a trust for someone who's a very small child. And there's not a lot of control you have at a certain point of those funds should said person not be as upstanding of an individual as you might have hoped they would become when they were three. At the end of the day, a lot of these trusts are exactly what the law says it is. It's yeah, you get your money. Good luck. And a lot of people use it to destroy their own lives. And mom and dad or whoever set it up have very little legal leverage to stop it. But it looks like they had some leverage to stop it here for those several years. I mean, and that can just be simply, we're not making the transaction. Legally, we have to, but we're not going to. You're going to take a court to force us to do it. And if you got the addict or the junkie who doesn't have the legal means on their side to fight for that, well, then it doesn't get transferred, illegal or not. I'm wondering, you know, is this a lesson of being more cautious of blindly putting money into a trust? I get the tax benefits of it. It makes sense. It's ways that you can save money for children and not have it taxed. It is very advantageous. It's a great mechanism, but there's a lot of assumption going on that person's going to be able to handle it at a certain age. Should this be reevaluated in general, or is it, you know, you roll the dice?
Yeah, Tony, you know, I think most of us have encountered like a trust fund baby. It just at some point in our lives. And some of them are doing great and they're prosperous and productive. And some of them are the opposite. Some of them are just sort of coasting through life. They have money and they are destroying their bodies, destroying their minds, not working, getting into drugs, things like that. And so I think that, you know, it's fun to be like optimistic in the beginning and say, oh, you know, this kid's going to be great. But what they should consider is building more discretion for the trustee into these trusts. Mm-hmm. My understanding is this one for the Reiners was pretty mandatory and obligatory. There wasn't really a lot of leeway that anyone would have legally to say, hey, we don't want to give you the money. Perhaps you can build in those conditions that say, like, hey, if the person's experiencing with contending with substance use at 30, then the trustee and their discretion could withhold the payments. I think you could build those provisions in, but I don't often see them.
Yeah, I guess that's the question. Like, can that stuff be built into a structure like that? Or, I mean, that's it's probably like a financial attorney type question, because you're getting into tax law and stuff as well with that, as far as the restrictions of giving that money out or that person taking their money at a certain point. I know there's different repercussions for withdrawing. You know, it's like withdrawing early from a 401k or something. There are certain structures with these trusts that exist with the IRS that, so I wonder, I don't know the answer to it, or if like we can reject giving this to you, but then you're going to, whoever made the trust will then face the financial penalties from the government for tax. I don't know, but it would be nice if there were more provisions that existed to protect someone that needs protecting. But then again, you go down the rabbit hole too of people who just don't want to give their money out at some point, or they're being petty and like, I want this money for myself. You didn't do this, or you didn't. There's a lot of reasons this could be abused as well. So if you go down the road of, well, let's tighten it up for a situation like Nick, then it also completely changed the dynamics for all the other situations out there that are probably far greater than his.
Yeah, it's interesting. So what I did, just because of all the issues surrounding this, I looked it up beforehand, and it's 40% of all probate cases in LA County involve trust disputes and litigation. 35% involve allegations of undue influence, 25% center on claims of lack of capacity, and over 75% are driven by undue influence, lack of capacity, fraud, improper trust administration. It's riddled with all these issues. And as I understood, and Eric, I don't know if you had an opportunity to take a deeper look at this, I just did a cursory of the trust that they set it up, totally inflexible. Is that the way these things work? Is that it, once it's established, it's inflexible? Because I guess that's how they do the check. Shelter of it is it's when it's completely out of the hands of those who had the money to begin with, they are no longer responsible or culpable financially for it.
Yeah, Robin, it seems like the trade-off that's happening in a trust like this are that if the funds are protected from tax consequences for a substantial period of time under the essentially the guarantee that at some point they are going to be dispersed, and at some point there might be additional tax and financial ramifications because of that. So I can understand why perhaps flexibility on these trusts is disfavored, because a person could put all this money in a trust, not have it taxed, and then when the payday right. comes, they could say, I don't want to do this, and I'm come up with some excuse, and the government's not going to get their money. And so I could see how flexibility might be disfavored under these sort of financial vehicles.
Yeah.
Lots of questions. How can what can the Reiner family do? What are Jake and Romy looking at in terms of what they can do to protect their money, to protect themselves, and at the end of the day, protect their brother who is not able to really make sound decisions? And that's an opinion. That's the important part. That is an opinion. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We're going to get all into that in our next segment. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss it. So Nick Reiner filed his petition. Now the ball is in the family's court, literally. Jake and Romy already cut the money off once, and the trust itself has been a revolving door. The payout was reportedly withheld for 2 years before Paul Kanin took over in February. Kanin raised his own concerns about Nick's judgment, and now he's out. Brand new trustee, Jody Montgomery, was just appointed and is already apparently asking to meet with Nick. Eric, Kane's stated reason for not giving into the past, capacity to make sound decisions. Nick's lawyers have fired back saying no court has ever declared him incompetent. Kind of. I mean, how much weight does a trustee's judgment call like that? I mean, actually carry in a probate court? Because again, it's an opinion. It's someone saying he's not. It doesn't have the capacity to make good decisions. Well, great. That's kind of something that a judge or a doctor needs to make. And then the judge can go, yep, I agree with it. We don't really have that here. I mean, unless you go back to where he was, there was that moment several years back where it was under California estate where he was, what was it? There was some ruling that was made where he was, I think, incompetent. It was something. I don't want to say it incorrectly, but it was something where he was, do you know what I'm talking about? I'm trying to think what the terminology was, where he was under the supervision, basically.
Conservatorship.
Conservatorship. That's what I'm looking for. The conservatorship for that year, essentially. And then the way California law is set up is that the conservatorship can be battled, you know, 50 ways to Tuesday, because California doesn't like having conservatorships, and which a year it was lifted. So I don't know. Do they have much of an argument here when one person's opinion is they don't have the sound capacity to make decisions? Again, that's an opinion.
You know, if I was a judge, the trustee's opinion as to the capacity of the recipient would matter, but it certainly would not be dispositive. It would not just be taken as gospel and be like, oh, well, okay, this trustee can sort of do whatever they want. And, you know, because that's so ripe for abuse, Tony. And I think, you know, trustees under so many different scenarios could, they might not like the person. They might not like the person's girlfriend. They might, you know, these things can come up and they could use, you know, this alleged lack of capacity as a pretext to not give what is a lawfully obligated distribution. And so I'm not sure the judge is going to just, you know, look at that and say, oh, this trustee had good reason not to disperse, especially without some kind of a medical report, some kind of psychological analysis. I think that opinion alone really is not going to hold a ton of weight at all in the eyes of a probate judge.
Is there any way you think that the family can argue this legally and that would actually hold up or even get the time of day? Because it looked pretty rock solid just looking at how that trust was set up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they can talk about the conservatorship. They could say, hey, look, this guy needed somebody to manage his affairs because he was incapable of doing so. But if that conservatorship was then lifted at some point, that tends to indicate that the individual no longer required someone to make all of their decisions for them. And at that juncture, probably a court is going to look at it and say the distribution should have happened. And so I'm not sure how much legal foundation that this family is going to have to try to resist at least the distribution at 30 years old. Like it's the distribution at 35 years old, it's a much different story.
And I remember the conservatorship, when they initially had it, it was established, and again, this was when we first started covering this case, and so correct me when my memory fails me properly on this one, everyone, but it only lasted a certain period of time just because of, basically, I'm going to just butcher
this. The law
in
California.
Yeah, the law in California. I was going to say statute of limitations of it expired, and so they couldn't continue the conservatorship. So is there any way the family could argue that the law prohibited him from keeping it in place when they really wanted it in place, that actually could be a mitigating factor?
Sure. You know, I think a judge could look at that and say, you know, or someone could argue that, hey, the reason the conservatorship ended was not because he didn't need it. It was because of some other legal mechanism. He still needed it. So they could certainly make that argument.
At the end of the day, the path to Nick getting the money and making the argument of the 30-year-old that was entitled to a certain dollar amount that didn't receive it. That's, I mean, I don't know. It might be a pretty strong argument. But with all cases, you know, it takes time. It takes time to go through the legal system and for this to be worked out, for a ruling to take place. Are the Reiner kids, Nick and Romy, is this more of a game of running the clock out than it is necessarily arguing the principles of it? Because time is of the essence here for Nick. If he wants Alan Jackson as his defense attorney, well, Alan Jackson's going to want a guarantee of pay, and he's going to want that as soon as possible. He's not going to take hopefully this works out in court at some point and you get that $1.5 million. Let me invest $10 million into your defense through my own firm. It's not going to happen. And with this being a case that it's going to take some time to work its way through the system, how long does probate court take for something like this to work its way out? Could this take years for it to be settled? Essentially, can they run it all the way where he's not going to get the money for the attorney? He goes to trial. Slayer statute goes into place, and then that essentially rectifies the problem. Or would that rectify the problem? Is there an argument that can be made there of, well, yes, Slayer statute in place after the fact, but at 30 they were still alive, so he should still be getting that money. He's still entitled to that.
Yeah, you know, I do not think that the family could run out the clock. And here's why. Probate court can take months or years. It can be a very prolonged process. However, most states, and I believe California has, have a wrinkle written into the probate statutes that essentially says, if there is a time-sensitive need for legal counsel in a criminal case, including if the individual is charged with murdering the people who set up the trust as parents, that can really take precedence, and courts are going to look at that. They're not going to slow play that. They realize that time is of the essence, like you said, and I think that under these circumstances, a probate court is going to push this to the top of the priority list because of this pending homicide case for which the alleged beneficiary is requesting the funds now.
Can it be appealed?
Okay, sorry, go ahead.
What's up?
Can it be appealed? Like, say, let's say the court says, no, we don't agree with you. We don't think you should get that money. Can you appeal that? Yeah. Can he appeal that?
I think he can. I think either side could appeal. Yeah, I think he could appeal that. I think if the court said, hey, you do have to give Nick the money, the family could appeal that and try to delay things further. However, I bet if that happened, what the court would do was they would probably say, hey, he gets at least some of the funds now pending this appeal due to the time sensitive nature of things. And then if the appeal works out in favor of the family, perhaps he has to try to give the funds back or something, at which time they're going to be extinct.
And there'll be no funds to give back. Could this be, a lever from a defense standpoint? Let's say Nick goes to trial. Let's say Nick doesn't get the money. This court says no, or it's caught up in appeals, or it's just caught up in litigation. Goes to trial, found guilty, doesn't have Alan Jackson. It's a state representative attorney, and it's just end of day. That's what happens. Could this be an appellate issue for Nick to argue? Not that he didn't have competent legal representation, but he was not afforded the ability to have the representation that he would technically have been entitled to had that money been given to him. Should a court down the road on appeal or whenever they settle this decide, yeah, you can have that money. You're already found guilty, but here's the money. Enjoy a lot of Snickers and commissary and $1.5 million. I don't know. I mean, is that a road that could be traveled by Nick? And should he hold that in his back pocket if that's a possibility?
It would be a creative avenue. And certainly if someone is convicted of murder on appeal, they're throwing everything, including the kitchen sink, at the appellate court. The thing is, Tony, what comes to mind is that the Court of Appeals, if there was a conviction in a criminal case at the trial court level, Court of Appeals would review that criminal case and have jurisdiction to make rulings on that criminal case. I'm not sure the Court of Appeals would have jurisdiction to make rulings on the probate case and how an error in the probate case may have disadvantaged a defendant in a criminal case. I'm not sure that – I don't think that that's how court of appellate jurisdiction would work in that scenario. So the Court of Appeals might say, hey, it's unfortunate that Nick did not get the funds and that the probate court did what it did. But that appellate court does not have jurisdiction to say the error in the probate court gives you a new trial in the criminal court.
I'm just laughing because I'm watching Tony becoming a lawyer in the last couple of years. It's really good.
It's true. I mean, I'm always trying to think of these because it's like, you want me to play Monopoly with you, but you're not going to give me all the money to play. That's not fair.
I mean, so I did look it up while we were talking. So L.A. uncontested probate administrations in L.A. still take 9 to 18 months if it's uncontested, and if it's contested, 12 to 24 months. So they would need that rush job, as Eric was stating, in order to do that. And now, it could actually play to – boy, I can't believe we're going such weeds on this one. It could play to Alan Jackson's benefit and Nick's benefit if they did release, like you were saying, Eric, partially, because I looked it up. Typically, Alan Jackson looks for about $250,000 for a retainer on a case like this, on typical cases. And so if they release that much and Alan Jackson thinks he has a shot at that guilty by reason of insanity plea, it could be just enough to push him over that edge.
Let me ask you this from an attorney standpoint, Eric. Obviously, you know, there's ways to be paid. There's the money that comes in that you'd certainly make, but there's also, you know, the clout, the publicity, the celebrity that comes along with some of this stuff, the notoriety, which then of course pays itself off by getting more clients, more high profile cases that you can make more off of. What is the threshold here for someone like Alan Jackson when you're weighing, okay, I mean, Nick only has so much money. And at the end of the day, to, you know, someone like Alan Jackson, it's a lot of money, but it's not like change the world money when you're Alan Jackson, in my opinion, of $1.5 million, especially for all the costs you're going to be incurring for your team to handle this damn thing. So it's not like it's a massive payday either way for Alan Jackson, even if he were to get his hands on the money. But the publicity, that's certainly worth quite a bit. Is it worth enough? Is it worth it for someone like Alan Jackson to step in, get whatever he gets out of Nick Reiner, if there's anything, for the publicity of being the attorney in another case that America can't stop watching?
My inclination is that it would be worth it. And you know, Tony, I heard an interview from Alec Murdoch's counsel, Dick Harpootlian, and at least one other gentleman, I forget. And I don't know how straight they were being with the reporter, but they essentially said, hey, we pretty much got paid on the first go-round, and we're on it on this second go-round. And then the omission suggested to me that they are not getting the same kind of compensation on the second go around. Yeah. Yet they are still in that fight. And I'm wondering if that principle is sort of transferable to Alan Jackson in this case, that, you know, he's really hot right now in terms of a celebrity mm-hmm. attorney, and to sort of approach that zenith and have another nationally publicized case that he could win, that could sort of propel him into an echelon where he doesn't have to market anymore. He doesn't have to spend money on marketing and getting cases for the next, you know, 30 years or whatever. They're just coming to him in droves. And mm-hmm. so I think it's probably worth it.
Yeah, go ahead, Tony.
But does he need Nick Reiner to do that? I mean, there's a gazillion cases he could take on that are high profile that I'm sure people would love to have him on, where he would pretty much have a guaranteed payday. Is it worth the weeds of Nick Reiner, I guess?
You know, what an awesome problem to have where you choose the biggest cases in the nation.
Yeah.
and select what you wish. You know, I don't think Nick Reiner's case is massive, but it's not you know, the OJ case or something.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if Nick Reiner is the best case to choose for that purpose, but could be a darn good one.
Yeah. Does this go into the calculus of that too? Because, you know, so if Nick is found guilty, then he doesn't get the other half of the trust. That's, you know, that's pretty established because he can't benefit from the death of because he killed his parents, basically, right? And so Alan Jackson would be limited then. We say limited, you know, people like you and me say, wow, limited to $750,000. But like you said, it's chump change to a guy like Alan Jackson, except for that notoriety. Is part of that calculus of him taking a case like this is the challenge of everyone knowing, even though he's innocent until proven guilty, that he was the one that stabbed his parents, that he got everyone thinking that he might get away with it? Is that actually part of that calculus?
I think that certainly could be an element. And one thing too, Robin, that you bring up is, in criminal cases, typically you can't have a contingency fee, meaning you can't have a situation where you get paid more if you win. That's unethical.
Right.
But in this scenario, if he wins, perhaps Nick gets that second payout, at which point does Alan Jackson get a second payout? And so is this motivation potentially raising an ethical issue whereby Alan Jackson has such a pecuniary interest in the outcome of this criminal case that it causes problems? I could foresee courts and prosecutors looking at that.
And I only said that, I didn't mean as him getting a second payout, is because when I looked up his general fee structure on the possibility of the total fee being above 750, actually being in the million framework for the time and energy he puts in on a case like this, is actually within the realm of possibility. It's the only reason, because for billing purposes, he actually might be above that 750 that that Nick might get.
Something like, I mean, imagine a trial like this would cost, I mean, I have no idea, but we're probably millions and millions and millions of dollars. Like 1.5 is just kind of scratching the surface, right? Wouldn't it be?
You know, it's certainly going to be an extremely costly trial. You're talking about attorney's fees, not only for Alan Jackson, but he's going to have a legal team.
There's
going to be a lot of attorneys. Yeah. There's going to be paralegals. You're going to have to hire a number of experts. Those people are going to be costly, and it's going to drag on for a long period of time. There are filing fees. There are all sorts of expenses that are going to be associated. So, yeah, a high, high price tag on a case like this.
And the mental health fees alone to do all the testing that they're going to want to do on Nick, paying for those in LA County is not going to be cheap, as you said.
Right.
I mean, like, just the fees alone, I mean, $1.5 million sounds like a lot. It would go pretty quick, honestly. Yeah. Just if, you know, to try and put up the defense of Nick Reiner that would need to be put up in the defense of Nick Reiner if he's going to truly fight this in court. Or, you know, I mean, I guess maybe if you get to a plea, I don't know, maybe less expensive if it was a plea that came through this. I don't know. It would be very fascinating, though, as to where the twist and turn takes us next here in the Nick Reiner case. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of the coverage on that. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Let's go to another case. Alec Murdaugh is getting a new trial, and now we know who's running the courtroom. Her name is Judge Deborah McCaslin. And the second she was announced, people started digging into her past. Who is she? What's the deal here? She's a judge with a reputation for being tough, fair, and impossible to rattle. But there's one thing that she said years ago under oath that has people asking whether Alec Murdaugh just caught the break of a lifetime. Attorney Eric Faddis is with us to help break all this down, and we're going to get into the story here of the new judge in the case. Eric, it broke the other day that Judge McCaslin is a new one on here. I was actually on an interview at the moment with Eric Bland talking about the case when that all came down, got his reaction to it. What's your reaction to this judge now that we've had a little bit of time to learn about her past?
I'll tell you, Tony, on every case, every civil case where we're going to file a lawsuit and every criminal case that I'm considering taking, one of the main questions is who's going to be the judge or who could the judge be? Because those folks can have such an influence over the proceedings, over what happens in the case, you know. And then there are some civil cases where we say, oh, gosh, we've got this judge, so we've got to consider these arguments. We've got to consider these angles. We've got a different judge, so we've got to refrain from this type of advocacy and those things. And so really can make a tremendous difference. And I'll be interested to see how much of a contrast this new judge is with the last judge.
So one of the things I had read when I took a look at this one was that, yeah, she made those comments about the defense attorney those years ago. But she did so, like Tony said, under oath and is actually part of her confirmation hearing. How common have you seen it that this actually pops up with judges having made positive statements about teachers, mentors, and guides in their past? And have you seen it impact negatively or positively? In other words, have you seen a bias from it from any other judge in your past?
Really, what I've seen, Robin, is this being having sort of a heightened magnification at the federal level, including during, like you said, statements made during the confirmation of federal judges, you know, by whom they were appointed, by which political party. And then you look at the case, if there are political potentially implications in the case, you know, like a case against a congressperson or a case involving political corruption, those kinds of things. Oftentimes, there will be motions to disqualify, or motions to try to recuse a judge because, hey, this judge has expressed a bias in favor of Republicans and the defendants are Republican or something, or, you know, just whatever. So that's kind of where I've seen it come up, including in this heightened political lawfare scenario we found ourselves in the past, you know, 4 to 8 years.
Do you see prosecution trying to maybe make that attempt on this one, saying that she should be recused from it because of those statements, or is it so common that they'll probably just waive it and just move on?
prosecutors are less inclined to go down that road, in part because you're sort of questioning the judge's professionalism when you make such a request. And especially if the judge is like, no, I'm not going to recuse. Now they're just might have a pretty bad taste in their mouth with respect to that prosecutor.
And you thought you were going to use not much of that financial stuff before. Why are you going to see it now?
Yeah, I mean, you could get that. You really could. I mean, you could really poison the waters early on and put a bad taste into her mouth. I mean, people are people at the end of the day. She's not a robot. And she really has a good track record of being fair. And that's great. I mean, looking at this, I'm looking at it. I don't have anything that I've looked at where I'm going, huge red flags. And, you know, and having talked the other day with Eric Bland, it was, you know, it was interesting to hear from someone who has some skin in the game here, who is invested in that ecosystem with the very players of this show, if you will. Even he was saying, good choice. She's a good judge. She's a good choice. But that being so, you know, just playing devil's advocate, you know, because I think it's important to do so. The advantage here is going to be to the Murdaugh team for this judge, because at the end of the day, if the verdict comes back not guilty, the state can't go retry it. The state can't go and say the judge made a statement years ago about Dick Harpootlian, made an impression on her life. They were tight and they were friends, and it swayed that the state can't do that. It doubled, the game's over. It's the ruling, but the defense certainly can. If it goes the other way, if this were different, if the dynamics were different, if there was some sort of sense of allegiance to one side or the other, the defense can always come back and appeal. So their advantage is on their side here. They don't really have an argument, though, either of saying, well, it seemed like they were tight and they still found him guilty and the judge was harsh. But the dynamics are certainly on the side of the defense for this round. Would you not say that?
Oh, totally. And I remember being a prosecutor and kind of complaining about that double jeopardy constraint, in the sense that, you know, oh, this judge screwed up this trial and now it's not guilty and we can't do anything about it. Oh, woe is me. And now that I'm on the defense side, I sort of enjoy that potential advantage, just in the sense that if there is an error, there is a potential legal recourse for it. So, yeah, I think it's kind of all the benefit with not much of the risk on the defense side with respect to this issue.
But at the same time, though, do you see, so say it plays out like it did the first time and she's a tougher judge, she's rules, process, procedures, I mean, her reputation precedes her, as well as the fact that that she did say good things about the defense. And if Murdaugh's found guilty again, does this then mean it's more challenging to have appeals by defense?
Necessarily, there are still appellate avenues, but yeah, it's sort of, I think, especially in the eyes of the public, bolster this notion that he was guilty, and he even had, you know, a ref who could be seen as being on his side, still guilty.
Play it out for us. Say a judge likes one of the lawyers in front of her, even a little. I mean, how does that actually show up in a courtroom? What would we see? Because people are people. Judges are humans. Attorneys are human. Have you ever witnessed that, where then it was brought up, you know, in an appellate issues or just in criticism of the case? So does this happen in the real world, Eric?
Oh gosh, all the time. All the time. There are, you know, there'll be events where, you know, the dinners where judges are going to prosecutors' homes and they're kibitzing and being social and everything. And same with defense attorneys and all of that. Yeah. And when you get to that courtroom, you know, the judge has to make a call. So they're taking arguments from both sides. And sometimes they'll even make comments like, you know, I've known Mr. Prosecutor to be very fair and to be prompt about disclosing evidence to the defense. So on this alleged discovery violation, you know, I just don't see any merit in it. And anyone can sort of read through the lines being like, this judge just likes the person. And that like that like and that positive impression, that positive opinion of the person seems to be creeping into the ruling and happens all the time on both sides and on the bench.
Is there I mean, we see it in all industries, this sort of thing, too, where it's like certain people will cozy up to other people because at the end of the day, it will give them some sort of an advantage. And real, genuine relationships can form there. And people can be professional and objective and do their jobs. But again, people can be people. Is there incentive sometime, or do you see sometimes prosecutors... And I'm not saying this is going on here by any means, but I'm just more so big picture question. Do you see sometimes prosecutors trying to get, you know, overly tight with the judge for the advantage, becoming buddies? Like, you know, they're fishing buddies, they're drinking buddies, they're vacation, all the shit. Just they're social friends. And then here comes trials. But, you know, we're professional. We can handle it. Does that exist in this ecosystem?
Oh, gosh. Absolutely.
My cousin Vinny.
On the criminal side, on the civil side.
Everywhere,
On the civil side, you know, you have a mediator sometimes who's trying to resolve the case. They're often a former judge.
Yeah.
Well, you know, people can have parties at conventions in a penthouse, and lo and behold, the mediator's there, and the plaintiff's attorney's there too, and you know they're having a great time, and then they've got a mediation a week and a half from that. You know, the same thing that happens on the criminal side too.
Yeah.
Is it intentional? Is it blatant? I guess that's up for debate, but
I mean, everybody, it's all part of the same ecosystem. So I can understand, you know, you're going to cross paths with people in that ecosystem. I guess my question on this with Alec is the ecosystem that small that there wasn't anybody that you could have picked that didn't have even the slight, you know, suggestion that there might be favoritism or connection or anything beyond professional behavior? And I'm not saying that it wouldn't be professional, but just the aura around it. Is there nobody else in the ecosystem that could have been chosen to be the judge for this case than her?
There are a ton of options, and the bench really has to be mindful of not having not of course engaging in propriety, but also avoiding the appearance of
that's
impropriety.
The thing. Why? If the is the pond that small? I mean, I don't think it is. Why even set it up this way for us even to be having this conversation? I guess.
Why exactly? Why take the risk? You know, I'm sure there is some new judge who's 40 years old or something who's competent to handle the case, and the chief judge in that locale could have appointed that person. But instead they appoint someone who's made favorable statements that appear to be a bias in favor of one of the attorneys, or at least someone could look at it that way. Why take the risk? I don't know, man.
So I'm going glass half full on this, maybe because they knew if he gets convicted again, there'd be less pushback because of those statements. Maybe. And I'm also curious, Eric. So here you are, if you are the defense attorney for Alex, and what would you be doing different prep-wise from knowing you had Judge Newman first time and McCaslin this time, from what we've seen and from her past and everything? What would be different, if anything?
I would have my team pulling all of her prior orders on issues that could be implicated in my trial. So how much of the financial crime stuff is going to come in round two? Appellate court said it was problematic in round one. But the judge still has a decision to make in round two. So you pull all these orders where the judge was deciding whether to let in other acts evidence under similar circumstances. And you say, hey, in this order, the judge gave weight to the fact that the financial crimes, the amount in controversy was really high. It was in the millions. That's something that matters to this judge. We're going to talk about that in our motion. We're going to talk about that during our oral argument because we think that's going to resonate with this judge because we have demonstrable evidence that it has before. That's just one example. And so you really research the heck out of that person and their prior rulings and try to craft and tailor your argument in a way that they're going to be receptive to.
So basically, they start triaging everything they have because you have limited bandwidth and with the resources you have. And so they start triaging what, based on the research of her, of what would resonate well and what wouldn't resonate well differently from the first case, correct?
Oh, yeah, totally.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And some judges have issues that are really important to them and issues that they don't care about. And so you get a complete understanding of all of that, and then you lodge your advocacy in line with that understanding.
I know we don't know much because you haven't had a chance, and no one has to really dig down into all those types of rulings. Can you see anything glaring right at the forefront that they might shift from the first trial to now, or not yet?
Not quite yet. I think we gotta sort of see how these proceedings are going to play out.
Yep.
It's going to be fascinating to watch. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, as always. Always fascinating to have you on and get your insight as we dive into the minutia of all this. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me. It's available wherever you get books. Go and check that out. Or audiobook. And that's going to wrap it up for today. Until next time, for Eric, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
The world's biggest soccer tournament has arrived, and you can trade the entire tournament on Kalshi. Spain is currently trading at over 17% to win it all, meaning a $100 trade pays out over $530 if they win soccer's biggest prize. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code JUMP to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see Kalshi.com/regulatory.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
The world's biggest soccer tournament has arrived, and you can trade the entire tournament on Kalshi. Spain is currently trading at over 17% to win it all, meaning a $100 trade pays out over $530 if they win soccer's biggest prize. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code JUMP to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see Kalshi.com/regulatory.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.